This week, the tables are turned, as I'm the guest on another podcast called Funds and Founders. Hosted by Abhinav Sinha, the pod explores the untold journeys behind founders' breakthroughs. In this case, me. So across this one-hour conversation, Abhi explores my views on lifelong learning, building communities, the differences between New York and Austin, forming Fabrica Collective, and the power of storytelling, lessons from my failed startup, Panda Club, creating the impossible network, the memorable interviews, and the power and value of the network it's become. He also inquires about my support system and asks about my most transformational business experience, which might be a bit of a surprise. Now, what I thoughtlessly forgot to acknowledge was the importance of my partner, Elaine, on my journey. So, making amends now, thank you, Elaine. And now, over to me.
And I saw online that you've mentioned you're committed to lifelong skill development. Mm-hmm. Let's start there and talk about why that is. Why are you committed to lifelong skill development?
Michelangelo said, he had this quote, "Ancora imparo," which is, "I never stop learning." I've always had that belief that we are on a journey, and it's a journey of discovery. And the day you believe that you know everything is the day you are essentially giving up and you're stopping your journey. And the opportunity we have through life is to continue to learn, and it can be a conscious decision you take to seek out opportunities, experiences, people that continue to help you develop to the person you ultimately will be when you die. And I don't think we are that person until the day we die, from the day we're born. And it is a journey, and I've always believed that and continue to embrace the belief that every encounter, every experience is an opportunity to learn something new and to improve who we are as human beings.
Nice. What are some things you're currently learning?
Where do we start? How long have we got here?
As long as you want.
Well, let's start with the obvious one, AI. I mean, everyone is abundantly aware of the impact that the massive acceleration, the exponential sort of growth of AI, not just that, Amy Webb at South By, I saw her do her trend talk and talking about the super cycle that's happening at the moment, where it's not just one GPT or general purpose technology, it's three, it's biotech, it's a combination of AI, and it's a combination of the Internet of Things all coming together to create this vastly superior sort of technological sort of super cycle that will change everything in life, everything we do, the way we work, the way we engage with each other, every aspect, and everyone will be touched by it. So wherever you work, everyone has to be cognizant to where the opportunities and the risks lie in terms of what that technology is going to do to our work, our skill sets, and to not see it necessarily as a threat, and it is a threat, but as an opportunity as well, to embrace it, to work with it, and to focus in on what will make you a better individual, a better human being. Yeah, like everyone else that I speak to, I'm on that journey to try and identify where I'll be 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years from now in this rapidly changing world. So that's one. The second, as you well know, we're both members of Steph Smith's Internet Pipes. Brilliant community, full of information and knowledge around how to navigate the internet in a more effective way and apply it to our work, to our lifestyles and whatever it is, and coming up with ideas, generating ideas, visualizing ideas. So that's a learning curve as well. Not that I'm not aware of the internet, but Steph's on a different level. So there's been that. And I'd say the third thing is not so much learning. This is more about trying to feel my way forward in terms of how we as individuals can discover our core humanity in this world of AI and come together and build community. Because I think we are, everyone in their own particular way, post-pandemic, post the impact of social media and all the other things that have been happening and what we might call the polycrisis that we're facing as a world, are struggling to find out how we connect with each other and can build community, build connection and collaborate together in more effective ways. So I'm sort of feeling my way forward in that. Nice. Haven't got an answer yet, but I'm on that journey of discovery.
Quick tangent there. What do you define as community? What does community mean for you?
Community in terms of, if we just look at it as a, the way we, where we've all grown up. I grew up in Scotland. I grew up in many, many towns, small towns, large towns, and very large cities outside the UK as well, from being born in a place called Arbroath to being a teenager in Tehran. Community means different things in different situations, different scenarios, but it's neighbors, it's family, it's friends, it's people you work with, where you can collaborate, communicate with them, work with them, build things together, create spaces where you help each other, you support each other. The nature of community has changed in over the last 4 or 5 decades to where we are now increasingly disconnected, where there's less discourse. And if there is, it's coarse discourse. So how can we start to rediscover that community? Now, for example, a couple of things I could talk about in terms of when I was in New York, I did a project called Back the Neighborhood, which was really during COVID, trying to understand how we can come together as residents, retailers and restaurateurs to rediscover the core of what a neighborhood actually is. Because at the heart of communities, the heart of big cities, there are always neighborhoods. Sometimes these can be street blocks, or it can be a small district within a city and a neighborhood. And those neighborhoods have defined the character of places and spaces. And we've lost that, certainly after COVID. And I think a lot of people are working in the community space to rediscover and to reimagine what that is in the future. There's a guy in the UK, and he's connected with, I don't know if you know, Baratunde Thurston, who talks a lot about democracy and citizenry in today's world. Well, John Alexander in the UK has written a book called Citizens, and Citizens, his whole premise is that we've been living in, me coming from an advertising background, John did as well, we've been living the consumer story for the last century. The story that determines who we are by what we buy. And we're always one purchase away from happiness. And that was fine all through the post-industrial revolution. But in recent times, it's fractured. And we now feel it. We now feel that the consumer story is broken. People do sense that there's more to life than just ownership of possessions.
100%.
The old traditional story pre-industrial revolution was the subject story, where we were subjects to fiefdoms, dictators, monarchs, where we were there to be in service of them.
Yeah,
we are at risk in today's world of being drawn back into that subject story by strongmen dictators and the likes. We won't get into who they are, but it's pretty obvious if you look around the world where these types of stories are re-emerging. But the natural story that John talks about in his book Citizens is a citizen story, where if we go back to the original pre-industrial ages where we lived together in smaller communities, we looked after each other. We were communities.
100%.
We collaborated. We helped each other. We exchanged goods and services. There were support networks, whether it would be family and extended support networks. He believes that in this post-industrial, post-consumer story, we have to reimagine what the citizen story is going forward, where we might still be globally connected, but we've got to be locally supportive. And that's where real community starts again. And it's that reimagining of that. So a long, convoluted answer to what is community. But I think it's wherever you set out to, with an intent, with an intentionality to build human connection again from the ground up.
You've lived both in New York and a couple of years in Austin now. Have you seen a difference in the kind of community available in New York versus the kind of community available in Austin?
It's a tricky one because I know Austin's an amazing place. And when I first moved here, I was part of the Trends group, which I think was Sam Parr's startup community meetup. That was great to meet people. I joined a group called the Austin Entertainment Business, which is run by Jennifer Hutchins. Amazing community group to bring people together in the entertainment business, in the broadest sense, entertainment, to help people get to know each other, share their skills, exchange ideas, connect, and to offer their services to each other. And she's done an amazing job over the last sort of 7 or 8 years building that. And it's a wonderful community meetup space. And then there's now the Internet Pipes Austin meetup. And there's other great spaces and loads of startup events. So it's a very healthy scene. The difference with New York that I felt coming to Austin, I haven't found a space to join. I was a member of a place called Neuhaus, which was a co-working space designed for the creative community in New York. So everything from fashion, design, technology, digital designers, advertising people, PR, comms, all part of that network. And it was, they fostered community by putting on incredible events and bringing in amazing guest speakers on a scale that I've never experienced in my life, not in London, not in San Francisco, and certainly not here. And that brought together just amazing, skilled individuals, smart people, all with a curiosity to learn more and exchange ideas. And some of the experience I had over the sort of the 9 years I was a member of it was extraordinary. So it's very hard to compare New York and Austin when you've had something like an experience like Neuhaus. It's not like a Soho House. It's on a different level to coming to Austin. So Austin's great, but I can compare it to what I experienced in New York.
I've been to SF in New York quite a bit, spent quite a bit of time there. People keep saying Austin's a growing startup scene. And my response to that is that it's growing, but it's very early. Mm-hmm. And it hasn't gotten to the level of density that SF and New York have reached. And the reason I say that is a random Tuesday in SF and you'll get at least 10 to 12 events, mm-hmm. at least 50 people at most of these events. In Austin, it's very hard to get 50 entrepreneurs out mm-hmm. to an event on a Tuesday, Wednesday, regularly every week on the week, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that density just doesn't exist here yet. And it could be that people are not going out. It could be that the people are here. But I think it's still very early in that journey. And the community exists. It's a very different kind of community and a smaller community.
Yeah, I mean, you can't compare a city of 8 million 100%. People in New York and a density that is Manhattan or even Brooklyn.
Yeah.
You can't compare the two. Same with San Francisco. 100%. And it's because of the startup culture there with Silicon Valley. Of course, it's going to be different. I mean, as a city, even in the 2.5 years I've been here, I've seen a change.
100%.
And it feels more vibrant. And obviously post-pandemic as well. I came here just in the back end of the pandemic. So of course it was going to be quieter.
Yeah.
But clearly with the amount of people that have moved here, both from New York and the sort of the California area, naturally you'll start to see an emergence of new events and meetups.
Yeah.
But it's car culture.
Yeah.
Which is a little bit in San Francisco, definitely not car culture in New York.
Yeah. I think the other thing I just want to mention is that one thing I've noticed in Austin is it's a lot of early stage folks who are looking for support and help to figure shit out.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not as many folks who have been there, done that, who are available to provide the mentorship or guidance
mm-hmm.
versus in SF and New York, I've seen you have a good mix of everyone, right? You can run into people who've done what you're trying to do and they can, give you tips, advice, and you can catch up. And
mm-hmm.
I think that doesn't exist yet in Austin. It's probably going to happen over the next couple of years. But as of right now, I haven't seen that same balance.
Mm-hmm.
It's very weighted towards people earlier in their journey versus people who have, been successful once or twice already. One thing I wanted to ask you was, you have an extensive background in the advertising industry. Mm-hmm. How do you go from that to founding Fabrica Collective? What's the journey look like? How do these two things relate?
Well, it's all storytelling. I mean, advertising is storytelling. That's what it's there to do. I heard someone at South By say the original information technology is storytelling.
Yeah.
And it's true, around the campfire.
Yeah.
Helping to pass on wisdom, knowledge, to prepare people to live in a dangerous world. And, advertising is just whether you follow Robert Cialdini's six principles of persuasion, or you listen to someone like a great advertising legend that I work with in London called Paul Feldwick, who has, I think it's six principles of how to think about advertising. It's there to tell stories through different modes to engage people and to encourage them to make a decision, a purchase decision normally. But really it's about persuasion, trying to persuade people to take an action. In pursuit of some value exchange. I did that for many years, working in many agencies on many large brands, from IKEA to L'Oreal to Oracle, Microsoft, Nokia, and a wonderful experience. But I became disillusioned with the direction the industry was going 10 years ago. I then set out on my own entrepreneurial journey that led me to, through a couple of failed startups to then form Fabrica. And to do that, it was the belief that clients still need to have a support network of skills to whether it be to tell their story, either through advertising or some other form of communication and PR, or just through other platforms that they own themselves, from their websites to their applications. My background ranges from everything from client service to strategy to creative technology. So I thought, well, I'm in a perfect position to actually deliver those services to clients, but not using a traditional advertising network, which is we have everything you need within our network. But the reality is it's just an extended network of competing profit centers. So I set out with belief that there's got to be a more agile, lean way of delivering those services, and that's through a collective of a talent base and a talent pool of people that now exists around the world that we're continually connected to. So I've, through my career, I've worked with and met many talented people, and a lot of those people are now independent, probably aged out of the advertising industry, but are great storytellers, are great developers, are great designers. So where I need them, I pull on them.
Nice.
And to deliver value to the clients that I work with. And that's the journey I'm on. I still stand by that. And I think going forward in the world of AI, you're still going to need human talent. So I've got to reimagine now what that looks like in the next 5 years, not what it was 5, 6, 7 years ago.
Nice. How do you pick and choose talent, storytellers for a particular project? How are you determining what skill set is right for a particular client's needs?
If you're really practical, it comes down to usually the budget they've got.
Yeah.
If your client's got a very small budget, then you end up ultimately you will get what you
more. Yeah.
I mean, that's 100%. Just the reality.
100%. Yeah.
But it's understanding the specific need. I mean, if it's it's going to be a 60-second or a 30-second commercial, then it's a different set of skills than if someone needs some social media ads delivered in preparation for an event they might be doing in Las Vegas.
Makes sense.
That have to be put out on their social media feeds. So it's really understanding what the client's need is, understanding what their budget is, understanding what their attitude and preparedness is to how they want to convey their brand as well, understanding their values and understanding their what they stand for. Because what you don't want to do is miscast someone. I've learned that along the way, that it can lead to a bit of an impasse, let's say, and doesn't deliver quick turnaround projects. So it really is based on human understanding, both in terms of the talent that you're pulling in and in terms of the client and the client's business and the business and their brand.
You mentioned brand's values and story. You need to make sure that your ads, your creatives are on track with a brand's story, their vision, whatever they want to put out in the world, right? And you're aligned with their mission statement, everything. Mm. How often are brands coming to you with all of this predefined and ready? Because my understanding is, I feel like not all brands understand and have all of this ready and prepared. And not every brand knows exactly what their mission is, exactly what their vision, exactly what they want to put out there. And this is more early stage, not later stage, but...
Yeah, I mean, it depends. I mean, if you're working with a large 500, Fortune 100 brand, even they can be going into, let's say, a campaign period for the next year, and they need their brand, their planning, and their strategy defined.
Yeah.
Now, they'll have an idea of what it is they want to convey, what they're selling, how they want to position themselves. But the opportunity in advertising is to, and communication, is to tell a story in an original, compelling, engaging, and surprising way.
Yeah.
And that sometimes means you have to take a slightly lateral direction. So even clients that understand their brand, their values, what they think their core proposition is, what the message they want to get out, still, even then, there's usually a significant amount of dialogue and discussion and debate around the strategic and the creative implementation of that. When you're dealing with a smaller company, whether it be a mid-sized marketing technology company, or whether it be independent, let's say, importer of goods and services that then sell them on in a B2B space, or be just a technology startup, clearly they'll probably not be as sophisticated when it comes to understanding what they're having, probably not gone through the same rigor that a Fortune 500 brand will have around their brand, their mission statement, their vision statement, their core values. So sometimes that does involve a significant amount of conversation around it. But at the end of the day, it'll just be down to a founder and knowing what they're like and how they want to convey their message. So sometimes you just sidestep that and you simply just understand what it is they want to say and how they want to convey and help them in that packaging of that message and that communication, whether it be for a website, whether it be for some social media communications.
Makes sense. Has the journey of creating the Fabrica Collective been smooth and easy throughout? Has it been all bells and whistles of you started and you're landing clients right away and you're creating talent pools, or has it been a rocky journey?
I wouldn't say it's been easy in any way. No, I will say that I've been in a fortunate position because I've just got a very good network, and most of the work I get, it comes from word of mouth. Very rarely, maybe only on a couple of occasions, it's come through people outreaching through the website.
Yeah.
Fortunately, when we've had clients and we've done work for particularly in web development or application development, they've found out who built it, and then we've had people outreach to us. And I did this startup before Fabrica called Pundit Club back in 2015. Learned the harsh lessons of how not to do startups. A bad founding team with no unified vision. We launched too early with technology that wasn't ready.
Yeah.
And when you're trying to get product market fit and you're at angel stage with a team that don't actually have a unified vision as to where you're actually going, it's a recipe for disaster.
Yeah.
I experienced that firsthand, and also dealing with the issue of sunken cost bias as well. So I learned some harsh lessons along the way there, which helped me then sort of think about, now that was obviously a social gaming app, chat app for football fans, as in soccer fans.
The real football.
Yeah, real football. Very different when you're actually sort of doing an agency sort of a structure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I went into it going, I don't want to build too much too soon. I want to test out to see if there's a market for what I'm actually doing, because you make an assumption that a lean, agile network of talent that you can pull on would be something that logically would make sense to people. But often clients want the reassurance of a nice office space, name above the door, and seeing people turn up to meetings.
Yes.
Early on, there was a difficult time trying to find the, I'd say, clients that would be
open
recurring revenue.
Also, I think it's on the back end side when you're working with a talent pool, unless you have arrangements where, hey, you're going to give me 10 hours a week, it's hard to do resource planning on your side because you don't know when a client's going to sign and when they're going to start.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then you have to start forecasting out.
Particularly if you've got a designer lined up.
Yeah.
Or you need some a UX designer.
Yeah, yeah.
And the client's delaying on the scope of work and you lose that person.
Yeah.
And then you're in a real fix.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I've had plenty of situations like that. And what I'd say unifies both Pundit Club and with Fabrica, it was Ben Horowitz, who's part of Andreessen Horowitz, had this quote that really resonates. It says, "I sleep like a baby. I wake up every 2 hours screaming." And that's often what it's like when you're going through those ups and downs moments of wondering when the next project's going to come in.
Yeah.
Or if you have gone beyond scope and you get into sort of a feisty discussion with client around what scope creep is. That happens in big agencies, it happens in small independents, but it's just something you have to be prepared for, and you've got to be prepared for uncertainty. I'd say that's been the most important thing I've learned over the last 10 years, is be comfortable with just the ambiguity and the uncertainty of running your own business, because things come in from different directions you just never anticipate.
100%. I know a founder in New York who's fighting a trademark battle with a company that does nothing on the same page, but they just out of nowhere happen to have the same name. One has .com, one has .something else. But it's like a random thing you now have to put mental energy towards that you didn't have to. It's not going towards clients, customer sales, product. It's a random offshoot legal battle that's also costing you money that you have to figure out because your investors want you to have your trademark figured out. And so it's like, I would never think a trademark is an issue, because if my product sucks, I don't care about the trademark, right? But it works very differently when you've raised, you have investors, it's a whole different ball game. And again, like you said, uncertainty is very, very common in that space.
Mm-hmm. When I did Pundit Club, the main angel investor insisted that we get a trademark. And that was a lot. When you look at your runway and you're planning what you're intending to do in terms of the first 6, 10, 12, 18 months, and suddenly you get sidetracked by saying you need to get a trademark and it's conditional on any further investment, and then the lawyers get involved and just the unanticipated.
What's one lesson you take away from Pundit Club? I know you mentioned there's a lot of things you learned, but if you had to take away one thing.
I'd probably say I did have a technology. One of the two things, it's not one. Don't do a founding team of 5 people. It's too much, okay?
Yeah. And all equal split?
Well, that was the other thing as well. I'll come to that.
Yeah, yeah.
But the technical founder who I'd worked with before and I trusted didn't want to get his hands dirty and do any of the coding. So he was insistent that we outsource that to a third party. Someone, again, I'd worked with before, great team in India, but there was a breakdown in communication between him and the lead developer on that that led to some real technology issues with the integration of a Opta, which is the company that do all the score tracking in the UK for all the UK leagues. The integration of that just was never done as well as it should have been. So it was buggy. And when you launch a buggy product to football fans and it's like 90 minutes and plus 3 and it says 90 minutes plus 11 back in the day, they're like, what the hell is this? That was a big mistake. A technical founder that needs to put hands dirty and is part and is doing the coding and prepared to fix things. And he wasn't prepared to do that. Yeah, too many voices and also inexperienced one founder that thought that it was their idea and their initial idea and they thought that initial idea had equity value. The rest of the team were all experienced and trying to tell a junior member of the team that ideas have no value. It's the execution of the idea that has value.
Yeah.
That caused a major split that ultimately led to the breakup and the failing of the startup.
Got it.
And not getting product market fit.
Makes sense. I feel like co-founder conflict is a very high cause of startup failure.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be multiple things, right? But I think it's misaligned incentives with people coming in with one person wanting a payday and one person wanting to build a unicorn company.
Mm.
Both are very different paths, right? And if you're not clear about, hey, what does everyone want out of this? And what am I ready to put into this?
Mm-hmm.
It just leads to conflict down the line.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And also investors can sense it.
Yeah, 100%.
Even when you're presenting a unified face.
Vision, yeah.
They can smell it.
Yeah. And I think body language also gives away a lot. I guess in case of 5, it's easy to have a majority, a 3 versus 2.
Mm-hmm.
But like if that's happening a lot where it's like 3 versus 2 on decisions, some of those two are going to start getting pissed off and be like, hey, my things never make it through, right? Mm-hmm. And so you always need like clear direction, clear ownership, like, hey, this is your thing. We're trusting you to like figure this thing out. We're not going to interfere in your tech decision, but then things need to work and like shit needs to be on par, right? But I think it comes from experience. I feel like people need to face that once and face the co-founder conflict once to understand how to be better with it next time. I think you could read a lot. You can understand a lot. You can have the best agreements in place. But until you've been through that co-founder conflict situation, it's hard to know how to deal with it
See it. No, there's no question. There's value. There's value in it.
Yeah.
Clearly, there's value in failure. I mean, I think it's just a case of just going accepting, okay, learn this lesson, learn that lesson, and you just look at the next idea and the next startup. Yeah, I don't regret it. Looking back on it, I would do certain things differently now.
Yeah.
But it's
always in hindsight. Yeah. In hindsight, you always do everything different, right? Mm. I know the thesis behind Fabrica, but why go from like a tech product to service agency? Because these seem like two very different things, right? Was that journey different? Was it just a thesis you had? Did you understand what building a service agency means at that time? Or what was that journey like?
And worked in advertising. That was the DNA of everything
service,
I did.
Yeah, yeah.
So you understand clients, you understand what's required to build that. It was
value
much more consistent with everything I'd done in the past. So Yeah, it just made sense. I mean, I suppose I could say it was consultancy. Initially, I started out prior to when leaving McCann here in New York. I said I'd do just pure out consulting, strategic consulting, innovation consulting with IKEA. But you get clients coming to you and asking, oh, could you help me with my comms? Could you help me with my brand strategy? Can you help me build a website? You want to service those needs. So it evolved. And, you know, right now I help do consulting work from agencies that I've worked with in the past, working as an outsourced innovation consulting partner, to working with small independent clients in, whether it be in New York or Germany, who are just single owner businesses. So it does range from large scale consulting projects to just small scale one-off builds.
Nice. What triggered the starting of the podcast, The Impossible Network? How did that come about?
Procrastination. I had the idea back in 2000 and originally in 2007 when Apple launched podcasts. I thought, all right, this is really exciting. This is storytelling. And then didn't do anything with it. And then 2013 had the idea to launch one when I left McCann. Didn't do anything with it. 2015, just at the time I was starting Pundit Club, I just started, created the name Impossible Network and the domain and started interviewing people who were doing ordinary people doing extraordinary things for social good. They tended to be sports people, did quite a few interviews, didn't publish them, and then got sidetracked by the startup. So it got put on ice. So again, procrastination. And then come starting Fabrica, I went back in 2018 and thought, I really need to do something with the Impossible Network. And I still like the idea of telling the stories of ordinary people doing extraordinary things for social good, but not just about sport. And I always had this strong sense in the power of serendipity, that it's not something that's necessarily just luck. It's something you engineer through the decisions you take and the places you're prepared to push yourself to. I often say it's about going down the road less traveled, encountering the people, the experiences,
100%.
Open up opportunities so you would never otherwise have imagined. So I just thought, well, if I start again, why don't I just do an exploration of people and explore the impact of their parents, their upbringing, their education, and the journey they're on, and how serendipity has guided them and has impacted them. I suppose I went in there with a thesis that it's your curiosity combined with your preparedness to confront your fears, embrace failure, allows you to unlock serendipity. That's what I went in with. And I thought, well, I want to actually make it more than just simply, how do I actually unlock serendipity through the podcast? So I decided to make the last question, who do I interview next? So I don't decide who I interview. I have three people I started with. They all happen to be clients. And that has unlocked the most unbelievable serendipitous journey, Impossible Network that I've built, of people that I could never have met, never in my wildest imagination would I've got to meeting these people in the places I've met them. It's evolved a long way. It's led to business. It's led to new clients. It's led me now to the point where I am trying to take it beyond just the podcast and build community around it. And that's in the early stages of exploration as to what that community will look like. It's probably going to be small groups forming a larger community, probably small cohorts of eight to 10 people. It's bringing together what I'm calling storytellers, difference makers, and domain experts. They tend to be the sort of the people that I interview just serendipitously.
Yeah.
And these people are all tend to be working on areas to impact some positive change in the world. So without actually actively going out seeking these people, they tend to be the people I meet. And it's pretty inspiring. And I have begun to then connect these people together, post their podcast interviews, to engineer what I'm calling random collisions. Yeah. So by bringing together people like John Alexander with Caroline Narditi, a French woman doing really interesting work in the social space with John and his belief in the future of citizens, what happens when two people with equal passions, but where there's some sort of crossover, what happens when they connect? Where does it lead to? So these random collisions that I'm trying to engineer is the direction I'm taking the podcast. The podcast will still continue, but it's a means to an end.
Makes sense. A random logistical question. When a guest recommends, hey, here's who you should interview next, Is it someone they know and they can make an intro to, or is it just a...
Literally, the one I'm editing, I was editing earlier today, a woman called Lauren Hugg, who's based in Denver. She recommended an author, and I'm like, well, you need to make the connection. She said, oh, I don't know him. And said, well, okay, I will go out, and because you've mentioned him, I'll go out and try and connect, and usually through some degree of separation, you get to that person. But I said, you still need to give me someone that you know, that you think would have an interesting story that needs to be told.
I love that idea. I love that idea of asking folks, because I fundamentally believe that connection is just, like, everyone you want to meet is like one connection away from making that intro to you. And it's just a matter of how do you make your rounds? How do you get there? If you had to highlight just one story that stuck with you, 210 episodes is a lot of episodes. Mm-hmm. I would say I'm only 22, 23 episodes in, and I feel like this is so much work.
Mm-hmm.
210 episodes is a lot. If you had to pick one thing that stuck with you throughout the 210 episodes, whether it's a story, a moment, an interaction.
Probably one of my early interviews. I've mentioned it on probably in many times on the podcast, but Tyreek Glasgow, he ran a corner, like from The Wire in South Philly, a dealer on the streets in an area called Point Breeze.
Yeah.
Anyone that knows Philly knows that's not an area you want to really be hanging around late at night. So Tyreek ran that corner, but at one point he was shot 11 times, ended up in prison, but then reformed, came out, and decided to go back to the same corner he ran, but not to run for drugs, but to try and change people's lives, one house at a time, one block at a time. So he created the Young Chances Foundation, and he's been a guest on the podcast twice. I went there, first of all, on a cold day in September, and sat in this disused house he was trying to turn into a community space in Point Breeze. But yeah, he's an amazing story of transformation and creating hope and opportunity and doing it. And that's an example of community. Understanding that you don't change people's lives en masse, you change it one house, one person at a time. What he's doing with the Young Chances Foundation, I met him well before he became a CNN hero.
Yeah.
Stayed in touch with him. Then had another guest I interviewed who was a rapper turned podcaster, Corey Cambridge. And I took Corey back to Philly from New York because he knew all about the music industry. And we did a class on how to think about the music industry for these kids in one of the local schools that Tyreek supports. And it was wonderful to see in the space of an hour how Corey changed these kids' view from wanting to be either a singer to be wanting to be a manager and a producer when he talked about the realities of the music industry and how it works. When you meet people like that who are changing people's lives and changing the world, it really is inspiring, and it keeps you going and believing that amidst all the negative news cycles that we are bombarded with in our feeds, there are people on the ground all around the country, in cities, in neighborhoods, doing really good work and changing people's lives. And there's stories that need to be told.
I like it. I think it's just a very interesting way on how there's so many people with so many interesting backgrounds and interesting stories that you're just very unaware of. Like people like just assume so much. And I think I'm partially biased because I consume a lot of tech startup content and knowledge. Like you'll just see all the big people making the rounds on the podcast. You'll just see all the big names. Mm-hmm. But there's so many nice stories, struggle stories of how people found their way to the US, got their way out, made a company, sold a company, brought wealth back to their family, their country, whatever, right? But you don't see as much of that and you don't notice all those stories because not enough people talk about them. But no, I really like what you're doing with the podcast. Has it been difficult doing 210 plus episodes? What's been the podcasting journey for you?
It's only been difficult recently. Last year was a bit tricky because I was spending a lot of time in the UK because my mother died and had to take a bit of a hiatus during that time. It's been more challenging recently because I've been busy, very busy with Fabrica projects. And also I've had quite a few clients that have had to cancel. So I've been knocked off. I was very good. I was doing one a week, every week for about 3 years. That was intense. keeping up with that level, that pace,
that cadence,
and the amount of preparation, the research,
100%,
the editing, the social media. Now, it has got easier with tools like Descript, and with AI, it is becoming easier and faster to turn things around. I'd say it's being disciplined. It's like training. It's like going to the gym and saying, if you don't do it, it's very easy to get out of the habit. I will admit, at the moment, I am struggling to get back into that weekly rhythm. Like, say, I'm editing one today. It is just a case, I don't know why. I've never encountered it before that people said, oh, I have to push it back, I have to push it back. And that's been, that is frustrating, because that then also leads you to go, oh, okay, then I'll just leave it this week. But people get used to having weekly drops, and you see a difference in the numbers when you're not delivering every week. So that's a challenge. What else?
And are you doing all the post-production yourself right now?
In New York, I was doing two. I also had another podcast I was working on with a client in New York called The Raw Hospitality Show. That was all done, filmed in person at Neuhaus. So when I was doing that, I was outsourcing both the editing, that was video, that one. Mine was just audio at the time. I was outsourcing that to a guy in Serbia, a great editor, and also a Ukrainian as well for the film editing. My friend and editor in Serbia, he had a family health issue with his wife and had to sort of stop. And that coincided with Descript getting to a point where I went, you know what, I'm pretty comfortable with that. I hated myself when I had to do editing myself on Audition or anything in Premiere Pro, but I'm very comfortable with Descript now.
Nice.
So I'm pretty much doing all the editing myself.
Descript also has like a text to video edit now.
Yeah, it does.
Right?
Yeah.
So the reason I ask is, I'm working with these podcast guys who emailed you. They do everything for me on the back end. Even with just booking a guest, researching, and coming in studio, I do nothing after this. After this, it's all them. And that itself is a lot of work. I don't think I would be able to do a weekly cadence if I had to edit the episode, put the intro outro on the book, do the shorts, put them on social. And we're only doing YouTube right now. I'm going to start Instagram, LinkedIn, all that stuff, right? But it's so much work.
Yeah. I worked out it was about 23 hours a week of work.
For one episode.
Yeah. So you've got to be prepared to make, you make sacrifices.
Yeah.
And it's great. And listen, if you're meeting amazing people and you're building a wonderful network.
100%.
And that's the value out of it. And I never set out to do it to make money from it. It was done as an experiment for myself and to really feed my own curiosity to build my network. So where it'll go down the line is going to be based on how I form the community around it.
Makes sense.
So that's the challenge going forward.
I applaud your 210 plus episodes. I think when I started this, my initial goal was, let me get to 25 because I want to first hit that milestone before I worry about social media, before I worry about doing shorts and traction and because I don't want to look at numbers and I don't want to have a conversation with clickbait in mind. I don't want to do a podcast and be like, oh, that's a good clip. Or that's what my title is going to be. Because that's not the reason I'm doing this, right? But it's very easy to get sidetracked because I can see what shorts are getting views versus what are not getting views. And so I know what people want to watch, right? But it's very hard to be like, hey, that's not the goal. The goal is to have good conversations, to build better relationships. And even if the podcast, the long episodes don't get the amount of views, that's perfectly fine. That's not the goal. But just the way society, it's very easy to get sidetracked with.
You can think about podcasts in the way I think the most people do. They see it as, if you think about the amount of people that make money from it, there are people like, obviously, here in Austin, Joe Rogan, Chris Williamson, Lex Fridman, all doing amazing things, great interviews. But it is a little bit, and Joe Rogan's different, but it is a bit like the circuit.
Yeah.
Book people who have got a book to talk about, a movie to launch. Then there's all the people that are doing their own specific, in their own specific lane with a podcast about something. It might be about electric vehicles. It might be about psychotherapy, whatever. Yeah. And they're great. And you've got very niche audiences. Yeah. And that's good if that's what you're after. Originally when I started, people said, no, you need to be really specific. I said, no, I'm not being specific because this is based on what my guests recommend. So it could be anyone. Now, for me, the value of it isn't just, the podcast is just a means to an end to build a network. So if I look back and think about the fact that I met Sharon Feldstein, who is Beanie Feldstein's mum, Jonah Hill's mum, And she introduced me then to Alicia Keys' mum. And as a result of those relationships and then running a mental health event with both of them in New York and bringing in the Jed Foundation, I met at the point, I'm not great with American football, safety for the New York Jets. So I've met all these amazing people and stayed connected with them. And as a result of knowing Alicia Keys' mum and Jonah Hill's mum, I managed to get hold and I met the mum of Adam Levine. And I got Adam to donate his guitar for this charity event I was doing. That's the podcast. The podcast unlocks incredible opportunities to build trust and relationships. And for me, that's community. So going back to your first question, what is community? The podcast is a means to build community.
100%. I was talking to someone a couple of days ago who wants to do a podcast about just breaking down movies and talking about what's happening in the movie, like from a more theoretical sense. Mm. Not just, oh yeah, this guy won, bad guy, good guy, right? Like more, hey, why is this lit this way? Mm. Why is the shot this way? And he's like, it's easier to get a lighting producer on a call and like a camera DOP on a podcast because no one wants to talk to them. Everyone wants to talk to the director.
Exactly.
But you can get the lighting guy on the call and talk about, hey, why is, like he was talking about Dune 2, why is this lit this way? And there's a whole theory behind it. I'm not a big film buff, so
I'll give you an example of why that's resonates. So I was introduced to this guy, I can't remember who connected me with him, Corey Cambridge. He had a podcast called Silent Giants.
Okay.
And it was the stories behind the giants of the music industry.
Yeah.
So he went out and found out, who's Michael Jackson's choreographer? Who did Vogue choreography for Madonna?
Yeah.
Who was the producer on, I don't know why I'm thinking Michael Jackson, who was the producer on Bad?
Yeah.
And he went out and met them all. He was the one that introduced me to, this was a great connection. Oh yeah. Because he was looking at the design of a great album, he found out that it was Debbie Millman who does Design Matters and she runs the School of Visual Arts in New York. So when I said, who do I interview next? He goes, oh, you have to interview Debbie Millman. So he introduced me to Debbie. Amazing person. I mean, she's one of the oldest, the OGs of podcasting. And had a wonderful afternoon in her studio with her. And then, I can't remember now who she connected me with, but it's been amazing.
Yeah.
So again, that story of what he's doing is amazing because by getting to know the people behind the movies and why movies are the way, he will have much more enriching conversations and learn much more and engage and entertain people much more because it's not your standard conversation that's been crafted by the PR and the spin companies behind the artists.
Small tangent there. I came across a podcast. He's a thumbnail guy in Austin. He does thumbnails for like Cody Sanchez, Noah Kagan, all these guys. He has a podcast called Backstage Creators, I think. And he talks to all the guys who work with all these creators who are booming off, right? Like, hey, what was your content strategy? What was your this strategy? And like, I was like, oh, that's an interesting take. Like you're saying, same theory, same concept of like, let's talk to people behind the face. And how are you guys, why are you guys succeeding? Like, what are you, because it's not always the creator who's the reason behind success, right? And I like that those kinds of insights are a lot more valuable than just talking to the face. And I like those theories. A couple questions I was just going to ask that I like asking every guest at the end is, what's been your support system throughout your career? Multiple companies, starting your own thing, doing the podcast. What's been your best support system?
What do you mean by support system?
So when I say support system, I mean just like, for example, my support system would be my family. I have my wife at home. Mm. And like just our relationship and the way we interact enables me to, you know, have a 9-to-5 and an agency and a podcast and you know, always be on a grind and a hustle from that point of view. So what would you say has been your support system in building multiple companies, building the collective?
Changes all the time. I mean, obviously, I live in Austin. I live in New York. I live in San Francisco. My family are in Scotland. I've been married. I've been divorced. I've had multiple relationships. I've worked in big agencies. I've done consulting work. I've had my own business. I've had my own failed startup. I know many people and many friends. So I'd say supports. I've never really thought about a support system. I'd say it's more fundamentally, it's about having, to build on what you said, yes, having good friends that will be honest with you and call out bullshit is really important.
Yeah.
And be prepared to listen to them. That is universal, I think. I'd say remaining fit has always been absolutely critical to everything I do and having energy. I'd say I've been fortunate through most of my life not to have been required a lot of sleep, but now it's increasingly important that I track it through my Whoop band and my Apple Watch or whatever device is the flavor of the day. I'm much more conscious about my sleep patterns now. My diet's always been really important.
Nice.
But I've also had a healthy consumption of red wine, you know. But no, I mean, in all seriousness, yeah, friends and family, knowing that they're always there for you, having your back. Yeah, it's just really a good diet, a good healthy fitness regime. Yeah, I think it's also, going back to what I said earlier, it's your upbringing is really important. I was very fortunate to be brought up in a place and a time where I was immersed with change and uncertainty, moving from school to school, which has prepared me for the ambiguity and the uncertainty of the life I've led. So I feel in a way I'm being blessed with that. It wasn't a conscious decision. It's just happened to be the way it is. So I don't get fazed with what might lie ahead or what's around the next corner. I'm not a worrier. I just plan, but I take each day at a time.
I like it. Are there three resources that you would recommend to someone listening who's early in their stages of building their company or venture or agency? Three resources that have helped you? It could be a book, podcast, article, blog, whatever.
What's helped? Now, I don't want to say something that's been said so many times. I mean, the 1,000 True Fans by Kevin Kelly is a classic blog post.
I think you're the second person that's recommended that.
Yeah, it is very good. For anyone that's thinking about building something that you need to get to scale, so just, you know, you and your podcast, 20-odd episodes in, all you really need are those 1,000 people.
100%.
Whether it's for your newsletter or whatever. And I think that is an important thing to think about, particularly in the world we live in, that everyone's chasing scale. So that's one. I think Tim Urban, his Wait But Why blog, is an amazing inspiration of just long-form, incredible content. And I think it was, I think Tim Ferriss, when I first discovered it through him, was the great post called The Tail End, which helps you think very differently about life and family and the value and the impact of it. Though my family would probably say they haven't taken it seriously because I'm across here when they're in Scotland. But yeah, they could call me out on that one. I would say that, I don't want to say any usual suspect podcasts. I'd say the book, Viktor Frankl, Man's Search for Meaning.
Okay.
It's an important book for people to read to get perspective on the world that we're living in. Think about ourselves and humanity.
I would say all of these are still on my to-be-read list. I haven't read any of these. Mm-hmm. I do this thing on my show, similar to your last guest, where I ask a previous guest for a question for a future guest, and then I'll ask you one to give me one for a future guest.
Okay.
So your question is, what was the most transformational business experience that happened to you that changed your perspective on something?
I would actually say leaving McCann. It was a classic political stitch-up. I had a team. I'd moved from London to New York to run the digital and build a digital team in McCann, New York, when I'd successfully done it in London and had great success there. And yeah, it'd been interesting, a little bit much more political in New York, but built a very good team of back-end, front-end developers, UX designers, a team of creatives and designers, and it was a robust-sized team. The CEO that was brought in was my old CEO from London, who was resentful of me moving to New York, and he came in, and I was doing an event speaking about IKEA in Germany. I got a phone call saying, you're no longer required and your team have all just been let go in the space of 30 minutes. And that was a pivotal moment that I went, okay, I've got a choice here. It's 2013. The industry is changing. I've got a choice to make. I can either carry on and get another, I was EVP of creative technology.
Yeah.
I can either go for another senior job at a large ad agency and go around the Infu circuit and land another overpaid job, which wasn't bad. But I could sense, even back then, looking at where the future was going, that I knew probably my days in a traditional agency sense would be numbered. So I thought, and I'd always had the desire to do something entrepreneurial. Wasn't sure of what. I thought, if I don't do it now, I'll never do it.
Nice.
So I took that step into the unknown, and that was probably the most transformational, without question, the most transformational. Yeah.
I like it.
So well, you could put it down as people look at it and be like, that's awful. You've been let go and your team have been fired. But every one of them has landed up in a better place 100%. As a result of it.
I have only one viral post on LinkedIn, which is Indeed had a layoff last March. I was part of the layoff. And I made a post saying, hey, I was part of this layoff. But, you know, it happens. I don't think I was picked out of a purposefully chosen. I'm just a name on a list. 2,200 people are laid off. I'm going to use this as a notion to, you know, reset, figure out what I want to do. Even though I was on a work visa and I had a 60-day timeline, I didn't write a, I don't want to say pity post, but I didn't write it in a sense of like, oh my God, help me. And it was more like, hey, it happens. Mm-hmm. It's part of life. I got to figure out what I want to do next. I'm going to use this as an opportunity. Got over a million impressions.
Wow.
Because every layoff post was like, oh, hey, I got laid off. I'm reaching out to my network. And I'm not saying don't do that. I'm just saying I didn't want to do that. Mm. And I was like, hey, here's my perspective on being laid off. It's going to happen to you.
Yeah.
Because the company's never looking out for you, right? And so you always got to be on your front foot. You got to figure shit out. Was that call expected when you got that call, or it was unexpected when you got the call saying you're no longer needed?
I knew it was going to be an interesting journey ahead, but I didn't think it would be so as soon. Brutal and swift as that knife went straight in there.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Did it take time to deal with that, or was it like you recovered pretty quickly?
I was more concerned for my team.
Makes sense.
And would they be okay? Because I knew what some of them were like as characters.
Makes sense.
Myself, I was much more of, I'd say, circumspect. I'm like, well, okay. I mean, I knew what this guy was like in terms of his character. And it wasn't unexpected. But, it didn't faze me in any way. I just thought, well, you know, I just always believed that things work out.
Yeah.
They always do. I mean, it comes down to, I don't want to sound trite and like positive thinking, negative thinking, all that, but it is, I had believed in myself. I believed in my network, and that with imagination and effort, hard work, and with the right intent, something would emerge.
Makes sense.
So, and it did, yeah. But it was transformational, no question.
I like it. What's your question for a future guest?
Oh, right. I'll ask the question I ask all my guests now for the first question on the podcast. What is it that makes you fundamentally human? And it can't be what they do. It has to be, what is it that makes them human? So it's got to be about who they are as human beings.
Like a trait or characteristic.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
People struggle with that question because it's easy to say what they do or where they come from. But it's very hard for them to say, who are you as a human being?
Makes sense.
So that's the question.
I like it. They've been getting very deep lately, so I'll see how my guests react.
Yeah.
But thank you for coming on. That's all I had for you.
Thank you very much.
Where can listeners reach out, see what you're working on? What do you want to plug? What can we link for you?
Go to the Impossible Network podcast on either on YouTube, Spotify, or Apple.
We'll link everything, yeah.
I've not been great with the Impossible Network on Instagram. I tend to, and even just my own, Mark Fallows on Instagram, Mark Fallows on LinkedIn. Or Fabrica Collective, if you want to talk about business and the future of your business in the world of AI. I've just updated the site recently, so
nice.
It's an ongoing process. LinkedIn, Instagram, I don't use Facebook, YouTube, obviously, could do with a few more subscribers.
Nice. Sweet. But yeah, we'll link everything. Thank you for coming on.
That's great. Well, thank you very much.
I appreciate the conversation.
I appreciate it too. Thank you.
Thank you.